have it?
This meeting of Health, Housing, Family Security Committee will come back to order, and we're going to start with Senator Lori's two bills, Senate File 2935.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Let me first offer an A1 author's amendment. This is an agency bill, and like often, we got a couple of little things to take care of.
Okay.
I think that's in our packet.
It's being passed out.
No, that's no. A2 is being passed out.
Okay. I've got an A2 as well.
A1 is in the packet, yes.
So I thought A1 was in the packet, and A2 was.
Yeah. A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then I'll also move the A2 amendment. This is a technical amendment.
And Lori moves the A2 amendment, which has just been handed out. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, now we've got the bill in the shape that we'd like to carry it forward. This is an agency bill. It's a Department of Human Services licensing bill. It's almost entirely technical and clarifying. There's a couple of things that are a little bit beyond that, but I'll describe it section by section here. Section 1 really rewords an exclusion for board and lodge facilities licensed by the Commissioner of Health. Section 2 adds clarifying language related to investigating alleged maltreatment. Section 3 adds a new paragraph G, which provides that a program may continue while a suspension or revocation is under appeal pending final order from the commissioner. However, under the new paragraph H, if that revocation is based on a disqualification of an individual who is ordered to be immediately removed from contact with the persons in the program, then the program may continue only if they comply with that order. And then a new paragraph K prohibits the commissioner from issuing a license if the tribal authority has established jurisdiction to license the program themselves. Section 4 rewords the subdivision related to the provisional license. This is related to Section 3 again. Section 5 defines the term reasonable cause in the licensing subdivision related to an expedited hearing after an immediate suspension of the license. Section 6 adds a cross-reference to the new paragraphs G and H, again, referring back to Section 3 that's been described already. Section 7 is another technical change, requires that training for SIDS and shaken baby syndrome for foster care providers be approved by the private licensing agency if that's what's applicable, and the county or private agency is responsible for monitoring the child foster care provider under this chapter. Section 8 replaces the term juvenile with children and strikes obsolete rule references. Section 9 requires that the video presentation related to SIDS and shaken baby syndrome be part of the initial and ongoing training for caregivers and helpers caring for children in a licensed setting. This is a clarification of current practice. Section 10 modifies the chapter of law related to services for individuals with developmental disabilities. Specifically, this subdivision related to reporting incidents by adding a new paragraph requiring that a death or serious injury occurring in an ICF be reported to the Department of Health and the Ombudsman. Section 11 amends DHS background study statutes to clarify the term care of a physician. Section 12 specifies that the 15-year look-back only applies to certain petitions relating to the termination of parental rights. Essentially, it narrows the scope of this disqualification to only involuntary termination of parental rights. It really corrects an inadvertent error from last year's session. Section 13 requires the license holder to maintain a copy of the background study if the study was initiated by a personnel pool agency, a temporary personnel agency, an educational program, or a professional services agency. And this really codifies current practice. And Section 14 adds to the list of disqualified individuals whose identity and the reason for the disqualification remain private. This is really specifically for children previously in foster care placement and then subsequently adopted by that former foster parent, now adoptive parent. That is the extent of the bill. I do have Jerry Kerber, the Director of Licensing from DHS, and Laura Zrust here from DHS as well, if there's any questions.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Torres-Rabe.
Thank you, Senator. I am curious about
the addition of neglect in section 11. This is page 13, subdivision 18. You add neglect to serious maltreatment, and I am curious about how the impact for the process that you do in terms of assessment and alternative response. A lot of the neglect cases are handled through alternative response, and mm-hmm. now you are adding the category of neglect. I assume that it's just related to serious injury, but it's I just would like to hear more about the
right.
impact.
Senator Patricia Torres-Ray and Mr. Chair, that is still resulting in serious injury, and I will let Jerry Kerber describe exactly the change just from maltreatment to neglect in greater detail.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. And Senator Torres-Ray, what we're talking about here is not any change to the definitions of what might be maltreatment under the Maltreatment of Minors Act. But this is in the Human Services Background Study Law that talks about which types of maltreatment should cause somebody to be disqualified under the Background Study Law. And so what's happening here is just clarifying that, you know, there's generally, like in the Maltreatment of Minors Act that you're familiar with, there's maltreatment means both abuse and neglect. And so in the Background Study Law, it talks about when abuse and when neglect should be disqualifying. And there's a little different standard. There's abuse that results in serious injury already has a definition that you can see on page 14 starting on line 5. And so if you're not talking about abuse, then you're talking about neglect. And so what we're just doing here is clarifying on line page 13, line 30, striking the word neglect and inserting striking the word maltreatment and inserting neglect, because that's what we're talking about. And then just clarifying what we believe was probably the legislature's intent about what is the seriousness of the incidents that need to result in somebody's disqualification. We talk about what the care of a physician is. We're trying to put a little more substance to what that definition is. We're already clear that care of a physician shouldn't, you know, it's not when somebody takes a child to the doctor, for instance, and gets x-rays. That's not really treatment by the physician, that's more assessment. And so a lot of times when somebody goes to the doctor might order ibuprofen or might order, you know, bacitracin and bandage it. If it's something generally that somebody can buy over the counter and administer themselves, that really, for the purposes of disqualifying people from their job, isn't what care of a physician is all about. And that's what we're just trying to clarify here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
Further questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience who had concerns about the bill? I had one question about the language you had about if a tribal authority has jurisdiction that was just clarifying because it says it shall not issue or reissue. Is that because if a tribe has taken over jurisdiction, the department hasn't been fighting with any tribes about whose jurisdiction? It's just
right.
to clarify it's not your job to do that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
It's in Section 3.
We certainly, there are situations where there's more and more, from our perspective, we're seeing more and more licensing activity being done by tribes. And we're not interested in dual licensure and asserting our jurisdiction on tribal property or anything like that. And so this is just putting in state law. In the past, we were sort of relying on other more difficult to nail down for us understandings of sovereign nation and their authority. And so we're just putting it in our licensing act to say that if a tribe is licensing it and they have jurisdiction, then the state doesn't.
Okay. Senator Lori moves Senate File 2935 as amended be recommended pass referred to Committee on Judiciary. Is that?
That is what I, that's my understanding as well.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Take your other bill, Senator Lori, 2639.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have an A1 author's amendment for this bill as well I'd like to offer right at the outset.
Is that in the packets or?
I think it should be in the packet.
Did you copy that one?
What?
We're getting it. So why don't you go ahead and explain the bill with it?
I'll explain the bill with the A1 amendment incorporated as it is an author's amendment, and I hope we'd get cooperation on that.
Got it.
This is a bill for services with persons with disabilities modifications for providers. It's ARM provisions brought forward. Kind of cleaning up and moving forward some of the initiatives we put in place last year. Section 1 is going to be modified in the author's amendment, and it amends the Department of Human Services foster care licensing moratorium statute to add an exception to the moratorium for licenses granted to adult foster care settings using the alternative overnight supervision provisions that we enacted last year. Section 2 is deleted in the author's amendment, and this one, I don't know if this one did cause some troubles for some of the advocates, and so it is deleted in Section 2 is completely deleted. Section 3 amends the adult foster care data privacy and security provision by allowing a license holder to store for more than 5 days electronic video or audio recordings of adult foster care recipients if the recording is pertinent to an investigation of a reported incident of abuse or neglect, or if it is requested by a recipient for a specific reported incident of abuse or neglect. Right now, there's a 5-day limit on how long you can keep these, but if you've got something that you need to keep it on file for, we need to give them the specific authorization to keep it for purposes of that allegation. Section 4 starts with a conforming change from legislation adopted last year. That modifies the supplemental aid special needs diet provision by allowing a provider of services to also be the housing provider for home and community-based waiver recipients. That's paragraph F. The paragraph G extends until 2012 the option to choose housing that may or may not be owned by the service provider, but specifies that a multi-unit building of 6 or more units, only 50% may be used by recipients of this program. This is also changed significantly in the A1 amendment to conform with what I just described. Section 5 modifies plumbing standards and related agreements with municipalities by requiring the municipality to forward to the state all plumbing plans for supervised living facilities licensed for 8 or more individuals rather than all supervised living facilities, which is currently the case. So we're getting at the more home-like settings don't have to meet the more institutional-like plumbing codes. Section 6 amends legislation passed last session again, requiring the commissioner to consult with disability service providers and others to develop the single set of standards. Essentially, it just renames the single set of standards that we got moving last year, renames them the quality outcome standards. That is the extent of the bill. I do have Barb Jacobson with ARM here if there's any questions. Do we have the A1 amendment? Maybe.
Yes, we do. Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Did you want to speak to it or just?
I'm just here for
questions. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, I would appreciate a little bit more explanation on the deletion of Section 2. Just a little bit more explanation on what we're.
Yeah. Section 2, we adopted the alternative overnight supervision last year, a provision that was people are excited about moving this in this direction, but they did, at the end of the day, in conference committee, we did say that, okay, we need to make sure that everybody is okay with this, all of the clients at the unit that is going to go to this alternative overnight supervision need to sign off. It needs to be unanimous that this is a good place to go for this provider. And this provision, you know, that was a compromise reached at the end, and you know, it would help to get more places using alternative overnight supervision if it didn't require consent of everybody involved. So moving it forward sometime might be good, but it really did concern a number of the advocates, and we are able to get a significant number of alternative overnight supervision settings established even with that restriction, and so we'll have good models and pilots running to see how this works, and over time hopefully we will get to a point where we can remove this restriction, but right now is not that time.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lori, well, I think I carried that provision, and I'm fine with your bill here tonight, but I will note that no one has discussed this concern with me at any point in time, ever. So let the, I just, like, that be noted.
That's fine. I thought I carried it, but it was part of the, bill. It was part of the bill I carried. And I did work with you a great deal on it, and I probably should have done you the courtesy to say that, this is coming forward, but we, you know, the unanimous consent is what I guess I'll call it, was negotiated at the end of the conference committee. It was the kumbaya, peace in the valley, all right, we'll get some alternative overnight supervision going. That happened, and this would have not been in line with that, really, and it did provide a great deal of discomfort to the advocates still at this point. So we're going to let the alternative overnight supervision go with a, you know, a smaller number, but a significant number that we should be able to really determine whether this is working well for everybody. And I think that some of those concerns will abate over time, hopefully sooner rather than later, and we will be able to return to this in a year. We'll say a year, maybe, and leave it at that for now.
Senator Lori or Ms. Jacobson, the language at the top of page 7 on the recording of foster care recipients, I understand why we don't want to keep it for longer than 5 days, but are all these incidents reported within 5 days? I picture a lot of those things wouldn't be reported for a couple weeks sometimes. By then, obviously, you've destroyed it, but I know you don't want to keep everything 2 weeks, and then is there somebody, what's the situation with that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Barb Jacobson, the Chief Operating Officer from ARM, and most incidents, I would say in my experience, most incidents are reported fairly quickly, so, and we're trying to reach a compromise to not have things kept too long, but trying to reach something so that when there is a report, we at least have, for those instances, that video and audio data available.
So if another staff person or somebody else sees abuse, they better report it right away if you're going to have the video to show it.
Correct. And those people, those agencies who are using video currently have found at times just having that video, because there is some monitoring of that. Sometimes that's how an incident is discovered, is through the monitoring, just the routine monitoring of those recordings initially.
Senator Marty, I would say that this is actually expanding the ability to keep it for longer,
right,
in terms in cases where there is an allegation, whereas under current statute there's no ability to keep it even if there's an allegation, and it could be very important evidence.
This makes obvious sense. It was just a question of
right.
But if they are often are found from the recordings, it'd be awfully sad to find it from that, and then we got to destroy the recording. I assume they don't record. I assume the practice would probably be they'd keep it for legal reasons in those cases and take their chances.
This'll probably.
Sure.
I mean, my guess is there's a statute on the book. I mean, I know there's a statute that says if you have evidence of a, you know, so I'm sure there's conflicting statutes, and these providers would be have to choose which one to violate. This one that compels destruction after 5 days, or the one that compels retention for any possible legal action. So, this does make sense to allow them this ability.
Okay, that makes sense. Are there any further questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who had concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Lori, move Senate File 2639 as amended be recommended pass, and I think this goes straight to the floor. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Either one of all the other. Senator Dowell, do you want to go next?
No, he can't.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Pittner, someone if you're ready.
Okay. It's still here.
2700 or which bill? Since you have several.
We can start with 2700.
You read everything? Senator Pittner, so on, sent filed 2700, and apparently you pulled together a delete everything A3 amendment based on lots of discussions this afternoon.
Where's that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we did, and I would say that there are agreements with several pieces of the bill, not with everything, but we're continuing to talk on those, and I want Lynn. And so I'm only looking at the amendment for the first time, so I would like these people to talk about
the amendment. Why don't we have
them
present the amendment, and obviously this isn't an author's amendment anymore because we've already been discussing the bill and acted.
Probably Mr. Ryman first.
Go ahead, Mr. Ryman. Welcome back.
We did get some alternative language over the weekend from the Council of Health Plans. We've looked it over. On the bill, there's six pieces that we went through. On the first, second, and sixth piece of the bill, we have agreement on the language and the changes that we made. Those were protecting the physician groups from having to term with a health plan and also being outside of the network for a reason just because they termed. So we've changed the language on those so that it now protects the individual groups, and that's no longer an issue.
Can you go through those three sections first,
yeah,
maybe, if they're the ones that's not under contention?
Yeah. I don't have the new language in front of me, but I know what the sections were. They're the contract amendment. Yeah, here it is. The contract amendment and renewal provisions. And now the change that's on there is that a health plan shall not communicate with members until final termination notice is received from the provider consistent with the law. And we're fine with the change that they made in that piece. Again, it's still protecting the physician group.
This language.
Right. A health plan shall not preclude a non-network provider from subsequent network participation solely as a result of the provider having termed their participation in accordance to the term of the contract. So again, we're comfortable with that change that they made it in the language on the piece and the language that they gave us.
Mr. Ryman, real quickly on that last part of it, what was the problem there? Was it that if I terminated my participation in network and then a couple years later wanted to come back, they were saying we're not going to let you?
Or it even gets into the point where, let's say, that the termination becomes effective. Because from the administrative thing, some of the things that the health plan runs into is by state law, 30 days before that termination notice kicks in, they have to send a letter out to all their members and say, this provider is no longer in the network. So this at least sets up a dynamic that if they send that letter out, they can then follow it up with an update. Let's say that it's January and you do reach agreement, they can let the provider back in the network and send a notice out to any of their members and let them know that they're now back in the network. So again, it protects the physician group from being opted out for 2 years or any defined time period. They can come back in
next day.
Yep. Yep, and there wouldn't be any limitation to that. So again, that protects the physician group. The second section on two, the change that was made from the past agreement, is On here, the health plan shall provide, upon request, any additional relevant fees to the particular provider's practice beyond those that were sent in the renewal documents for the next contract period for all participating providers. Health plan companies may fulfill this requirement of this section by making the full fee schedules available through a secure web portal for contract providers. Again, the concern from the health plan is they, and again, I'm speaking for you, so let me know if I get too out of range here, but this could, the way we had worded before, they might be forced to give all 9,000 fees, even though we only bill 300 or 500 of them. And so this limits it so that if the group bills for that service, the health plan has to provide that fee. But if it's for services that are outside the scope of the physician group, the health plan does not have to supply that. Again, we're comfortable with that.
Mr. Chair, there is a oral amendment to the amendment, though, because this was never intended to cover the PBMs, and so they have been removed from the language of the bill, but there was one part that was missed. And so after the first period on line 1.19, we need to add the words excluding claims paid under the pharmacy benefit.
Before the period.
Before the period.
Excluding claims paid
under the pharmacy benefit.
Could you repeat it one last time? Excluding claims paid by?
Under the pharmacy benefit.
Okay, Senator Pretner, so in this amendment is, you've moved the amendment, so the amendment's before us, but we'll move to add that to this pending action on that. So okay. Senator Pretner Solon moves that oral amendment on line 19. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Ryman, you were going through section 6 next?
Yes, that was the last section that's on, I believe, the third page here, and that states that the collection of copayments, deductibles, and estimated payments from patients. The health plan shall permit providers to collect copayment, deductible, and insurance and coinsurance from patients at, and here's where the language change was, at or prior to the time of service. Overpayments by patients to providers must be returned to the patient by the provider in the same form in which it was collected within 30 days of the date in which the claim adjudication is received from the provider. Again, the health plan was concerned for their members that if we were to over-collect by chance, that their member would get back any over-collection within that time frame, and we were in agreement with that without any issue.
One question I just have, I understand why it should be done this way, except don't a lot of your patients pay with cash?
Yes.
How do you mail them cash?
No, it would be
Cashier's check.
It would be a check, but if they, I'm sure if they came in and demanded cash after overpaying, we would give them cash.
So those three sections, there's no dispute over
none.
Anymore.
Yep, we're in total agreement.
So, Mr. Chair, we're still working on tiering. On some language around the tiering. We're still working on language around
claim filing.
How long the clinics have to submit a claim, and then in return, how long the plans have to go back and grab back the funds if they feel like they've been submitted inaccurately or incorrectly.
And the language you have here, is it pretty similar to what we had this morning on those three sections?
Yes.
Yes.
And you're going to try and see if you can resolve that by tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon in Commerce.
Mr. Chair, I'm Lynn Nelson from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And we're confident that we can continue working on this language in the final three sections. On Section 5, we may have the biggest disagreement, but on Section 3 and 4, I think we can come to some agreement.
And Senator Pretner, so this is the language you wish to move now.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon moves a 3 amendment delete everything as we've just added, incorporate a little oral amendment, moves that to the bill. It's not an author's amendment anymore, but I think we all know what's in it now. Is there further discussion of that? Is there anybody who wanted to speak in opposition to the amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill as amended, is there further discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who needed to speak to the bill?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I should say that we never heard from the Delta Dental after that, so.
Is he here and Mr.
No, Lowry? He has not. We've tried to reach him, but.
Okay, well, he will be, I'm sure he'll be at Commerce tomorrow.
He might be.
You and I will both see him in Senator Johnson. Further discussion on the bill as amended. If not, all those, Senator Prettner-Solan moves that Senate File 2700 as amended be recommended pass, referred to the Committee on Commerce. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
We have three more bills.
I have two more.
You have two more. Senator Dow has one.
Yeah. Do you want me to take these now? Or?
You can take whichever one you want since you're sitting there.
Okay. I would like to take the pharmacy management bill.
2972.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this bill was brought to me by a pharmacy student from University of Minnesota Duluth who recognized that we had provided in many instances for there to be telecommunications or video conferencing of consultations for physicians in rural areas where there are not enough of the specialties groups. We also recently allowed for reimbursement for, yes, please come forward, for reimbursement for medication management by pharmacists. But there are a lot of rural areas where there are no pharmacists available to do the medication management. So what this bill does is allow for medication management to be done by video conferencing. And I have with me Andrew Zawicki, who's a pharmacist and a resident with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association.
Thank you very much. Senator Marty, thank you to the committee for hearing our bill tonight. Basically, as Senator Prettner-Solan mentioned, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. She had mentioned I'm a pharmacist. I currently practice at a primary care clinic in Minneapolis, solely providing medication therapy management services to our patients. Basically, what that entails, real briefly, is basically the pharmacist works with the physician and the patient to make sure that the medication therapy is safe, effective, and reaching the outcomes that both the physician and the patient and the pharmacist want to see. As was mentioned, in more of the rural areas, I guess I would be speaking on behalf of my colleagues that practice more in outstate Minnesota, where they don't quite have the access and the distance is large for their patients to reach these services. A couple of reasons why this bill is a step in the right direction, we believe, it's basically it expands these services to patients that wouldn't otherwise be receiving this benefit. It's eliminating this barrier, physical distance barrier that they may have, again, to reaching this benefit. It maintains the live interface between the pharmacist and the patient. It's making sure that even though it's not face-to-face in person, but it still does lend itself to establishing that therapeutic relationship and making sure that's enhanced. It's also following in line with other such services currently being developed and implemented via telemedicine on behalf of a lot of other healthcare professions. And then lastly, it's just making sure that all of these patients are optimizing their healthcare outcomes as well. And so it works in line with our goals as pharmacists. And again,
Mr. Zawicki, could you give your name for the record first?
I'm sorry. My name is Andrew. Last name is Zawicki.
And Mr. Zawicki, with the video conferencing, it's not allowed to be done into the patient's residence. Is it done at a pharmacy nearby? In other words, it's only a specialized pharmacist who can give this type
The way it's currently set up is it's basically adapting itself into the current framework of MTM. In order to be an MTM providing pharmacist, it's listed in current legislation. You have to have graduated after 1996 and be trained in some of the more clinical aspects of the pharmacist's degree. As far as going to homes, again, that's something that...
MTM is medication therapy management.
Correct. And the way it's set up now, it's provided in a clinic or in a pharmacy that has a separate private area for such counseling, not, you know, over the cash register.
But in most of those cases where you're doing it by video, it's going to be in a doctor's office. The patient will be in a doctor's office with a video link up, or?
Correct. It would be either in that ambulatory care setting, or if a community pharmacy has this video conferencing setup, it would be in a setup such as that. But this would primarily be in a doctor's office, assuming that you don't have
and
access to
that.
This is done
pharmacy. In a number of states, or are we one of the first who would be doing this?
That I'm actually not aware of. But I know we are currently doing it with physicians. And a couple other
Mr. Chair, it was only in recent legislation that we provided reimbursement for the pharmacist to do the medication management. And I think this probably has to go to the finance division, although what I'm really hoping is it's going to, there probably will be a slight increase in the use of this, but I'm hoping it's going to show a significant decrease in costs over the long run as chronic diseases are better managed by having the medication management performed. And in some of these rural areas where the doctors are sparse and there may not even be a pharmacy, the prescriptions are often mailed to the patient. It's not as easy to have that type of collaboration or the whatever they do. The
continuity of care.
Yeah,
making sure everything's maintained.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Partner Solon, good work. Your summary was excellent, and I think that this is an example of when we talk about reforms that need to be made and how we better focus on patients and on the forefront of prevention and the coordination of care, I think this is in fitting with all of those themes. So good work, and I'm very impressed with your student who brought this forward.
Okay.
This
isn't my student. This is an actual pharmacist.
He's actually hoping to be doing this.
Yes.
And this is the kind of thing where you hear once in a while where the pharmacist sees a patient who's on 10 or 15 different drugs and some of them interacting each other and causing things, and they get it straightened out.
See it a lot.
Saves a lot of money. So.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair. Senator Gorey.
And Senator Pretner Solon, I'm remembering this, that the commissioner may cover MTM under Minnesota Care if they determine that it's cost effective. Have they determined that and covered it under Minnesota Care? I was trying to remember. It's permissive language, and this is not amended, so, you may not have run into it. I was just trying to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Laurie, I'm not sure if it is being used now. Do you know
there
if it's covered under Minnesota Care?
Not entirely certain. I know there's a recent pilot program that's been implemented as of January 1st of this year, so they might just be a few months into it, assuming that's the same program.
Because
that's right, there's a pilot project.
And, Senator Laurie, it says that on page 1, line 12 and 13, or 13 and 14, that Commissioner can allow it.
Right, that's what I was referring to, the permissive language that's here.
They're just beginning to,
had done it. Or.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 2972? And this one does go to Finance. Senator, is there anybody who wished to express concerns about the bill? Any further discussion? If not, Senator Pretner Solon moves Senate File 2972 be recommended pass, referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon, 27. Senator File 2763.
Yes, this is my final bill tonight, Mr. Chair. And this is an important part of the Basic Protections Initiative that we initially introduced in 2010. 2009, wasn't it?
No, this year.
It was this year? Okay. Under current law, a married couple automatically has access to health-related information regarding their spouse, but same-sex couples in committed relationships are denied the same access. Even with such access requested in writing, it is not always provided, making it difficult and sometimes impossible for the ill or deceased person's wishes to be carried out. The Equal Access to Health Records Bill defines the term domestic partner and provides domestic partners the ability to ensure that their partner's wishes are carried out in healthcare settings and after death in the same manner afforded to married spouses. Additionally, the bill creates the same legal right to privacy in healthcare facilities for domestic partners as are provided to married couples, and recognizes a domestic partner as a family member according to the Hospice Patients Bill of Rights. And I'll walk you through the bill. Section 1 allows a surviving domestic partner access to medical records of a deceased domestic partner. Section 2 provides for patients' rights related to notice and access of health records to a surviving domestic partner of a deceased patient. Section 3, upon written request by a domestic partner, requires a mental health care provider to ask a patient whether or not the patient wishes to authorize their domestic partner to receive treatment information and to communicate that information if authorized. Section 4 states that upon oral or written request by a domestic partner, a mental health care provider is required to notify the domestic partner of their rights under Section 3. Section 5 defines domestic partner as two persons who are of the same sex, are adults and mentally competent to enter into legal binding contracts, have assumed responsibility for each other's basic common welfare, financial obligations, and well-being, share a common home with each other, have a committed interdependent relationship with each other, are not married to or in a domestic partnership with another person, and are not related by blood. And this is the same language that we passed off the Senate floor last year. Section 6 requires a non-acute care inpatient facility, including extended care facilities, nursing homes, and boarding care homes, to assure residents' privacy for visits by their domestic partners, and if both domestic partners are residents of the facility, to allow them to share a room. Section 7 requires that in the event of the closure, staff reduction, or operations change in a nursing home or boarding care home, the facility is required to provide notice, planning meetings, site visits, and accounting of personal funds to a domestic partner of a resident. Section 8 allows a domestic partner to assert hospice care family rights and to assert the patient's rights as a resident of such a facility if the partner is judged incompetent. Section 9 allows a patient's domestic partner to give informed consent for surgery or medical treatment at or by a hospital, community mental health center, or other treatment provider qualified to provide care and treatment for patients who are mentally ill, developmentally disabled, or chemically dependent if the head of the facility determines that the patient is not competent or consent to treatment. Section 10 requires a domestic partner's consent if a deceased person's organs, fluids, or tissue are removed for medical research purposes pursuant to an autopsy. Section 11 requires consent of a domestic partner before a medical examiner may exhume a body and perform an autopsy or conduct an autopsy if the body is to be cremated or disposed or so that it may not be later examined or if it is that of an inmate of a public institution. Section 12, for purposes of communicating authorization to two adults, one of whom must be a disinterested witness for making, amending, revoking, or refusing to make an anatomical gift during a terminal illness or injury, includes a domestic partner in the definition for being a disinterested witness. Section 13 adds the domestic partner definition to Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. Section 14 allows a domestic partner to give an anatomical gift of a decedent's body or part for purposes of transplantation, therapy, research, or education. So they're all related to patients in medical facilities. In closing, Minnesota same-sex families face significant hurdles when it comes to raising healthy, stable families. Current Minnesota law discriminates against these families every day. This bill will ensure equal rights for same-sex families to access health records. This bill will provide equal basic protection to same-sex families. Committed same-sex couples and their families live in every Minnesota county, and they are friends, family members, colleagues, and members of our faith communities. We must move one step closer toward fairness and equality for all Minnesota families. And with me today is Ann Kaner-Roth, Executive Director of Project 515, to make some brief comments and answer any questions that you may have about this legislation.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, as Senator Prettner-Solin said, I'm Ann Kaner-Roth. I'm the Executive Director of Project 515, and we want to thank the Senator for bringing this important bill forward tonight. Just as a way of brief introduction, Project 515 is a nonprofit organization with a specific goal of ensuring that same-sex couples and their families have equal rights and considerations under Minnesota law. In 2007, the organization identified at least 515 Minnesota statutes that discriminate against same-sex couples. And this piece of legislation before you tonight would move forward on 12 basic health-related rights to same-sex couples that are not currently in place in the state of Minnesota. Just a couple of brief things to highlight in the bill. The domestic partner language, as the Senator highlighted, was passed off the Senate floor last year and is a compilation of language that's used with more than 300 employers in the state of Minnesota, along with the University of Minnesota, all who offer domestic partnership benefits. And again, the bill does not change the function of how the law interacts with health information. It only expands to whom those functions are offered. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee may have.
Questions from Ms. Kaner-Roth? It's none. Mr. Pritchard wanted to speak with concerns about the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard. I'm president of the Minnesota Family Council, and we'd like to speak in opposition to the bill for several reasons. One is we believe the bill will, in fact, inject confusion and ambiguity into the law. The definition of domestic partner is rather vague when you consider it talks about assuming another person's common welfare or financial obligations and well-being or have a committed interdependent relationship. I think that is vague and will frankly open the door to disputes with family members or others who would challenge the assertion that a person is a domestic partner. Secondly, we believe the bill is discriminatory. It excludes coverage for family members or other individuals who have a personal relationship with another person. So we think the bill is, in fact, discriminatory towards other individuals. Third, we believe that this bill is unfair to married couples. Married couples have a status based on legal obligations. Domestic partnerships created under this bill have no such relationship or obligations. In a sense, individuals are receiving benefits without the legal responsibilities. And fundamentally, this is really merely an attempt to establish a precedent for establishing same-sex marriage. And, of course, this raises the issue of why is marriage legally recognized between a man and a woman? And we think that the marriage, the relationship between a man and a woman is a unique relationship, essential to society, the raising of children. Children need both a mother and a father, and that's the reason society gives preferential recognition to marriage, because it's the foundation of a stable, healthy society. And finally, we think this bill will open the door to legal attacks on marriage, because in many jurisdictions where they've established domestic partner relationships, those marriage laws in those states have been challenged subsequently. So for those reasons, we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Pritchard, I kind of wonder about, I mean, this allowing a domestic partner to make a decision about anatomical gift or use of organ donation and so on, I kind of wonder if you feel that's, I mean, who should make that decision for somebody if not their partner?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would ask, why does there need to be a domestic partnership status established for individuals to do that? I mean, the way the language is written, it is clearly, I think, intended to establish a marital-type status. Now, if you're concerned about other individuals, why not open it up to a wide range of individuals who might care for another person who aren't in a homosexual relationship? Other individual, let's say you've got two adult children who care for one another, uncles or cousins or other individuals who wouldn't be eligible. So why are you, I guess I would question why it's limited then towards this domestic status.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Prittner, so
it isn't limited. It actually just adds domestic partner to the list of people who can help to make those decisions about patients. It basically puts them in the queue. Most family members already have that right.
But yeah, it is adult children is the third one on page 8. Further questions or discussion from the committee? This bill goes to Judiciary Committee. Senator Prettner-Solin, anybody else in the audience need to speak to it? If not, Senator Prettner-Solin, move Senate file 2763 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's just not the same without our minority members.
It's changing. Senator Dow, Senate File 3095, and you have a delete everything amendment.
Mr. Chair, I do like to move that, get it in the shape that I would like to see it in.
Any discussion? This is the author's amendment. Any discussion? They want amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members. For you, Senate 3095 is addressing a concern that I think is going to be sweeping across the country, is it already beginning, is the massive increases we're seeing in health insurance rates. And though we may not be able to do much about the actual increases themselves, I feel it's important that we give, as we're asking consumers to take more responsibility for the health care costs and be a part of that process, that we give them an opportunity to weigh in on proposed rate increases by our health plans. If we look around the state right now, or the country, we're seeing rate increases by some insurance companies in California of 39%. We're looking at 2009, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan requested approval of premium increases of 56% for plans sold on the individual market. Regency Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon requested a 20% premium increase. United Health and Rhode Island requested 13 to 16% increases. Washington saw increases of up to 40% on individual plans until they impose stiffer premium regulations. Across the board, you're seeing increases. In fact, this past month at a National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the chairwoman of the Health Insurance and Managed Care Committee, Sandy Prager, said you're going to see rate increases of 20, 25, 30% for individual health policies in the near term. And this is a reason that we need health insurance reform at federal level. But short of that, what I'd like to do is and propose in this legislation is that we give the consumer an opportunity to at least hear from the health plan that's proposing the health increase, or have the insurance premium increase, along with the representative from the the Commerce Commission. And what this breaks down to is that in non-health plan, group health plans, and small employer health plans, long-term care insurance policies, or Medicare supplemental policies, where there was over an 8% increase proposed, that in four areas of the state, Duluth, St. Cloud, Rochester, and the Twin Cities area, if there's at least 100 members that are affected in those areas, that they would be able to participate in a hearing to hear from the executive or representative from the health plan, as well as the representative from the Commerce Commission, and to discuss this and take questions from the consumers. That they at no point, if there is an increase of over 8%, that any rate increases would not be approved or deemed approved by the commissioner until those public hearings had been held. That there would be a notify those members that were affected by mail of when those hearings would occur, time and place. The
It would also include the proposed, if you look at from 1.25 on down, one, that they would have a proposed rate of each insured specific health plan, including any increase because of the enrollee's age or health status, and the percentage increase of the proposed rate from the current rate. Two, that a statement that the proposed rate is subject to the Department of Commerce's review and approval, and that it would also have the date, place, and time of the hearings on the proposed rate. It would have the commissioner or commissioner's designee and an executive from the health plan sponsoring the increase would be available to provide testimony and answer questions, and that the health carrier would be responsible for paying all the reasonable expenses attributable to the public hearing. And we wanted to put this in place beginning this next January and run it for 3 years, so it would be effective. I wanted to actually have it 3 years. We've got it here for 2 years, which I could be fine with as well. But just to have it for a couple of years to see how it's working, to make sure that people are actually participating in this process. I don't want it to go on if people decide, well, it's not that important. But I think, again, in this day and age, with the emphasis on health care, the concerns with our recession, our economy as it is, and the need to get a handle on these increases in health care, that we need our consumers to weigh in on the process. And that's the bill.
Senator Dowd, do you have any witnesses to testify in support of it right now?
I do not at this time. My witnesses couldn't be here tonight. So if we get it to the next committee hearing, we would certainly have them there.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl, I appreciate the concern that you've identified, but I'm going to say that I think there's an awful lot that we can do, and I think there's an awful lot that is happening outside of this bill to address what the larger problem is, and the larger problem being the cost of health care, not only in Minnesota, and certainly not just exclusive to Duluth, St. Cloud, Rochester, and the metropolitan area, mm-hmm. but rather all across this state and across the country. And that's been the subject of so much discussion. We're focusing on, we talk about payment reform. I think payment reform, in part, gets to the issue that you've identified. I think, in part, that the focus on prevention, in part, gets at the issue that you've identified. I think if we continue to focus on high quality, low cost, as Minnesota has been certainly illustrative of on the national level, if we talk about best practices, if we talk about benefit design, all of those factors that are contributing parts of the healthcare reform discussion, whether it's in the state of Minnesota or at the national level, I think get to this. And I'm not yet convinced that holding a public hearing is the best use of our time and energy. And I think that we would all agree that there's nothing exclusive about the four communities that are specifically mentioned in this bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I agree completely with everything you said. I would prefer that, you know, we could do it across the state. I'm also being cognizant that, you know, there are costs that are associated with doing something like this, and trying to get in get it out at this point to a point where we could reach the maximum amount of people we can without having every county have a hearing over every rate increase that might be out there, where we have 2,600 hearings over a course of a year. So in an attempt to balance out the equation a little bit and provide an opportunity, at least for those who are interested, that there would be in the larger metropolitan areas, we'd be able to have said hearings. I know that they're doing this with MCHA at this time. They only do it in a couple of different cities across the state, with varying degrees of success. And so it's my attempt to strike a little bit of a balance here, that we're not going too far over but still give an opportunity for consumers to weigh in.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Dahl. To a couple of Senator Lynch's points, I had just talked to Senator Dahl before he started. I said, well, what about southeastern Minnesota? Because, frankly, and I know we're close to Rochester, but I would really like to see this statewide. And you don't have a testifier to speak in your behalf today, so let me tell you about a conversation I had this afternoon, right about supper time, with a woman in my district who's just experiencing all sorts of financial stress. She's got all sorts of medical issues going on. And the reason she called me is she's so frustrated with getting her insurance company to pay. And she said she's been paying in for years and years and years and years. And now when she needs her reimbursements and she needs her premiums paid for her coverage, she's running into roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And it seems to me that the interest or the industry is certainly interested in slowing down payments to their customers. And, you know, I think if this was going to give them one little road bump in their road to slow down some of their rate increases, I mean, I think that's just, it's just fine with me. We have to figure out a way to get our hands around cost controls for healthcare. And as a school board member, I would have loved to have the opportunity to have a public meeting on rate increases. When I was on the board 10 years ago, we were notified over and over. You know, we had double-digit increases this year and the following year and the following year. I would have loved to have public opportunities to talk about that kind of thing. So I think you have a good bill here. I'd like to see it go further.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dahl. I think some of this discussion about statewide in the four regions, I think that it is statewide in the one sense that if members from southeastern Minnesota are affected, there would be a public hearing. I think the four regions go to where the public hearing is held, so it may not be completely convenient for everybody, but like you said, MCHA already has hearings somewhat similar to this and has them in just a couple of areas. And then this kind of reminds me of the Public Utilities Commission hearings, too, when utility rates are going to rise. I don't know how they don't have those in every corner of the state, but constituents come in and do weigh in. So I think that it's statewide in the sense that when insurance rates are going up for individuals in southeastern or northwestern would be the one big
gap there.
The one big area of the state with not any of these four cities.
Mr. Chair and members,
correct?
If there are some other areas of the state that you thought were appropriate that should be included that I missed, I'd certainly would be open to that. But I'm trying to reach out as far as I can where and make it, so that's, it's not just one location where everybody has to travel to the Twin Cities if they want it, because I know that they're not going to make that trip. But if it's relatively convenient to go there, it gives them an opportunity if they're really concerned to come in and weigh in. And I think groups like, AARP and Take Action and those kind of groups that are dealing with healthcare right now on a community level and then with their groups would use this as an opportunity, as a forum help educate some of their members, too, to get involved and say, how do they get more active with the process and weigh in on these things. So that's the intent of the bill. And, I think the next stop on this, if it passed through this committee, is Commerce would give me an opportunity to, again, work on some of the language. If there's some things that need some further addressing, but I'd appreciate your support.
Senator Dahl, with 100,000 more people uninsured in the last couple of years, I think we're now the highest since the state started keeping track in the early 90s. So as the rates keep going up, we're covering a few people here and losing more there. Senator Prettner-Solon, you had a comment or question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl, as I listen to this, I just wonder what effect would a public hearing have, actually? Gives people maybe some chance to vent their frustration, but what effect would it really have to have a public hearing? It would be a costly endeavor. I mean, I understand. We want to try to understand and to reduce health care cost increases, but I'm just not sure that a public hearing is what's going to get at it.
Right.
And it might add more cost into the into it, I probably not a lot, but it could increase frustration too.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Prentner-Solon, I much like with a public utilities hearing, it may not have that much of a difference in whether that rate goes up or not, or the final effect on it and their decision. But it does give the public an opportunity to engage in that conversation, and I feel it's, you know, something like healthcare is it's that important that, you know, even with the additional, and I think it would be a minimal, but in addition, there would be definitely an additional cost involved, but it's something that I think that would be appreciated by, you know, the public to be able to engage in these kind of hearings, because they're the ones that end up paying these things. There are several states that are doing this right now and have implemented these things. Connecticut is the latest one, and they found that, you know, the Attorney General got involved last year with some of the rate increases they're trying to do, and that was one of their results was legislation that implemented such a hearing like this. And you know, I just think maybe, you know, the jury's still out as far as what effect that may or may not have, but I think it's part of this process to engage everybody in the process, get them involved, and give them opportunities to do so. And I, at this point, it's as though we, you know, we can read the newspaper, get that rate hike, and, you know, we can yell at the newspaper, the TV set, but that's as far as we can go. And, you know, this might be an opportunity for people to at least weigh in publicly. So that's really the intent.
Oftentimes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brittner, so on.
The cost of the increase is usually a negotiated item between a provider and the plans. And so I'm not sure really how this gets at that dynamic. Still, I see it a bit different than the public utility hearings.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dahl, you expressed interest in laying the bill over until...
Yeah. There's some work to do. I wanted to at least get the conversation started with this, and I think we could, you know, lay this bill over for additional work if there's ways to do that. But I was hoping I'd have the support of the members here, and so there's time to work on this between now and the next committee hearing. I prefer to actually move it forward if we could, you know, just take a hearing, and let's see if we get a vote on it.
Ms. Brunner would like to speak to it. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Julie Bruner from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and someday I'm going to come in front of this committee and testify in favor of a bill. I'm going to do it. So, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the author before the hearing, and I understand better some of the things that he's interested in. I also brought, this seems to be my day for handing out things, I also brought just a few pages of the commerce rate setting statute for the committee to look at, because the process that the Commerce Department goes through in setting rates is very extensive. We are very highly regulated. You will not hear about 50 and 60% premium increases in Minnesota, because the Commerce Department would never approve those premiums. We also have the requirement in Minnesota that premiums don't go into effect until they're approved by the Commerce Department. So in any case, the use of a Chapter 14 proceeding in rate setting for health carriers is not only unusual given the nature of Chapter 14 proceedings, but will add to the costs of healthcare administration. And similar to the point that was raised by Senator Prettner-Solon and comments I made earlier today, these things all add up. We have hundreds of insurance companies in Minnesota. I represent only 7 of the health plans, the Insurance Federation has hundreds of members. So what you're talking about theoretically are hundreds of hearings each year that have to be conducted by the health department. Medica has 40 plus products, so they would have to be doing this. These would be very complicated, multiple kinds of proceedings. There'd be proceedings like this going on every day all over Minnesota. I'm not sure that that's going to get at the problem of healthcare in Minnesota. The Administrative Procedures Act establishes two sets of procedures, one for rulemaking and one for contested cases. Contested cases are trial-like proceedings. Both of these proceedings may have a public hearing. However, only the rulemaking track sets forth an express process for the public hearing in Chapter 14, Section 14.14. One question I have is whether the public hearing referenced in the bill's requirement for a public hearing is the rulemaking public hearing process. This would be different than what the legislature has done for utility rate increases. The public utility rate increases process uses a contested case process subject to Chapter 14, but it is largely prescribed in Chapter 261B, governing public utilities, and Minnesota Public Utility, the Public Utility Commission's rules. So in order to have this, even have the potential to work, which I'm not endorsing, but to have it work, there would need to be major amendments made to Commerce Department's procedures to have this all work together. And I don't know if that's what the author anticipated or not. Chapter 14 imposes extensive process for notice of rulemaking hearings since the rules, when promulgated, have the force and effect of state law. Imposing this type of process on health insurance rate approval in a competitive health insurance market is, in my opinion, a significant mismatch. Currently, rate filings are not public until approved by the Commerce Department. It is unclear to me how a public hearing would or could inform the public during the process of review and negotiations with insurers, because this is not public information. The standards and duties imposed on the Commerce Department by 62A.02 subdivisions 2, 3, and 3A before the commissioner may approve a rate increase are highly technical. It is unclear how a public hearing will help the commissioner meet these technical requirements. If the intent is to make these rate filings public upon filing with the Commerce Department, it's likely to have some as yet unknown effect on the competitive market. The imposition of the cost of these hearings, and we're talking hundreds of hearings because they're going to be held in multiple places around the state, they might need to be conducted annually, will be paid by the insurers according to the provisions of this bill. Those costs will increase administrative costs in the insurance companies, who will then pass along those costs to individuals and businesses who are purchasing insurance. I won't be on my soapbox more than a minute, but we all want health care costs to go down. The only way to do that is to deal with the underlying reasons that premiums are going up. Consumers are using more health care, and the cost of that health care is more expensive every year. We use high-end drugs, lots of high-tech procedures, and we seem to think that more care is better care, and the more expensive the care is, the better the care is. And that is not a fact. So if we want to deal with the underlying cost of health care, I think we need to proceed with many of the provisions that the legislature put in motion the year before last and see how some of this stuff gels and takes effect and impacts the cost of health care. Thank you very much, and thank you, Senator, for the dialogue.
Thank you. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Only if they go over 8%. And an 8% increase is, you know, two times the cost of living generally, you know, or the COLA increases that we're talking about, and inflation, everything else. So it's only going to be a trigger that's tripped if they're over 8%. So I still think the bill is a great idea.
Mr. Chair, then if I respond to the comments, you know, there's ways I think we understand and trying to narrow this down so we don't have hundreds and thousands of hearings. And I think there's some, you know, there's some tweaks we could do here and there to manage that. You get it down to a more manageable number. And I'm not saying that this is going to change the effects of the rate increase. I know we still, as policymakers, have to work on those issues here. But it's an opportunity, again, for us to include the public in this discussion, and because they're the ones that ultimately pay this. And it's an opportunity for them to get out there and be a part of that process. And I feel strongly it's something that we should offer them that opportunity. But if there's a couple of things, if we can get it through this committee, and there's a couple of things that we find we can do to tweak it and narrow this scope a little bit so that it wouldn't be the thousands that you're talking about, because I can't, you know, I don't know for sure how that works. I'd be more than happy to include that in this language.
Ms. Bruner, you talked about hundreds and hundreds of hearings and all the rate increases. And how many filings do you think there are with the department every year?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that, but I know that the Commerce Department is here and probably could answer that question.
Welcome back.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Gross. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Department of Commerce. I talked to our actuary this morning, Julia Phillips. We get around 260 filings a year, healthcare or health premium rate increase filings. Of that, 87 filings were submitted in a year for a rate increase over 8%. They're talking about 87 filings.
And Mr. Gross, how many of those were disapproved by the commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't know. I'm going to go back and try to find more information about that. I know there is a number of disapprovals. The company sometimes will withdraw the rate request. A lot of times, too, there's a tremendous amount of dialogue back and forth with our staff about the inadequate amount of information or additional information we need. And I think there's always a number of filings that the company will submit for, let's say, an X percent rate increase, and we say that's way too high, and then there's a lot of dialogue back and forth, and they'll subsequently come in with something lower, which we will ultimately approve.
So out of the 260, I mean, it's hard to say there aren't that many actual disapprovals. There's some discussion about some of them, and some of them the plan will change the proposal.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are some disapprovals. Right. I don't know what that number is, but I will seek that.
I guess I'd appreciate that. Ms. Bruner described it as heavy regulation. I thought file, and you're allowed to increase after 60 days after filing unless it's disapproved. Is it 60 days, or how long does the commissioner have generally?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have 60 days to start a dialogue. Otherwise, it's deemed approved, and it's rarely we're going to let it get deemed.
Doesn't happen. So a typical one would be 6 months?
It could be 3 to 6 months, but I could find that information.
I'd be curious. I think the committee might like to see that if you could share with us. Good. Thank you, Mr. Gross.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion from members of the committee? Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the bill? If not, Senator Dahl, did you want to pursue Senate file? We had the bill as amended, right? Yeah. And did you want to change the sunset for 3 years instead?
Yeah, I originally was interested in having it a three-year program that would expire at the December 31st. We could just do January 1st, 2014 instead of 13.
It's 4 years.
Senator Dahl, in other words, it would be from the 2011 till 2014. You want to, we put the amendment already before us. So Senator Dahl moves to change 2013 to 2014. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill as amended, this bill would go to Judiciary Committee?
Commerce
Committee. I'm sorry.
Commerce. Yeah,
Commerce would be the one. Mr. Gross will be there as well, as will Ms. Bruner, so. Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 3095 as amended be recommended passed and referred to Committee on Commerce. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. With that, I think we've come to the end of the agenda. And so this committee will be meeting again on Wednesday at a regular time. And we will have a meeting that evening as well. With that, this committee is adjourned.
What's going on?